Welcome to Salty Moms Gone Sober. Whether you are a sober, curious, salty individual, can't seem to stay on the wagon, or have some successful sober time under your belt, our podcast creates a safe and comfortable space to let it all out. We can't guarantee anything but a good time and chill vibes. With a dash of humor, genuine language of the heart, and a salty truth throat punch here and there, connect with us on this unpredictable wave of sobriety. And when we find ourselves choking on a mouthful of saltiness, let's stop waiting to exhale and just spit some truth. Without further ado, your hosts, Alyssa Gruskin and Bree Juarez.
Hey Bree, how are you today?
I'm doing quite well this evening, Alyssa. How are you?
I am dandy, dandy, dandy.
So did you really believe me when I just said I was doing quite well this evening?
Fuck no.
Aw, that's because you're my best friend.
My little buttercup.
Because really, I'm like, dear God, make me a bird so I can fly far, far, far away. Dear God, make me a bird so I can fly far. Far, far away.
Amen.
Are you familiar?
I can't put my finger on what it is.
I think that fucking kick-ass chick that we're interviewing tonight knows what I'm talking about. Do you want to introduce this kick-ass chick, Alyssa?
Yes. So tonight we have an other amazing guest, and her name's Sydney Sled, and we're super excited to have her on here tonight. And I can't wait any longer, Sydney, so go ahead and take over.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. I loved your introduction. I was actually Jenny for Halloween this year, so that's why I was trying not to laugh too loud in the background. So my name's Sydney Sled. I'm a person in long-term recovery, and what that means to me is I have not found it necessary to use mood or mind-altering substances since November 21st of 2014. So I just celebrated my 8 years, which is an absolute miracle. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how I got here. So a lot of it starts in the family of origin, and my story is no different. I came from an alcoholic home. My dad's an alcoholic. My uncle died of this disease. There's just addiction doesn't run through my family. It gallops. A lot of mental illness in there as well. But the biggest factor of growing up in an alcoholic home was it was normalized to me. I would watch my dad come home after a long day at work, and how he would settle his nerves is he would drink. And my parents also did this thing that I think was kind of popular when I was growing up in the 90s, to where they wanted to demystify alcohol. And how they did that was they give me a little bit of wine, starting when I was like 7 or 8 years old, trying to kind of take the taboo off of drinking. But what this did in my little 7 or 8 year old body is I started really looking forward to dinner, because I would already get that little like warm, fuzzy sensation, and I already had an attraction to it. And the other factor is, you know, all these studies have come out about ACEs and their impact on addiction and alcoholism, adverse childhood experiences. And I had a lot of chaos in my home. You know, the jail was on speed dial. My dad was getting DUI after DUI. My parents got divorced. There was just a lot of chaos growing up. So in addition to the normalization of the alcohol, as I started getting older, my first drink was actually with my dad. When my parents got divorced, you know, my dad kind of took this role as the every other weekend or sometimes less frequent parent. And how he decided to try to connect to me was through kind of being the cool parent. I'm going to be the cool parent. I'm going to give you some wine coolers and let you bring your friends up here and party. And so that just became a thing that I did with my dad. The first time I smoked pot was with my family. That was also very normalized. I had a family members that grew and participated in that quite frequently. So a lot of those experiences, I mean, it was so normal to me, because I'm like, it can't be wrong because I'm doing it with my own family members. But there was something different with my attraction to alcohol. And I started noticing that like in middle school and high school, I would drink with other kids, but I noticed that they didn't drink the way that I drank. Because what would happen is I would drink until an external force stopped me. So that was either passing out or blacking out or running out of alcohol. Something had to get in the way or I was going to keep going. And that was from the absolute very beginning of drinking. And then as it progressed, I went and started experimenting with other substances. And I got into the harder stuff a lot quicker than any of my peers. So I got this job like working at a movie theater and hanging out with older kids. And like, it's that joke that I always hear about how like marijuana is a gateway drug and this and that. And for me, it was only from the sense that, you know, I was buying marijuana illegally. And then that person also had another assortment of things to try if you were bold enough. And so I started doing cocaine in high school. And that was not like a thing that the kids in high school were really doing. But I was experimenting with that and hanging out with kids much older than me. And it really started to progress. I found some other kids that did kind of drink like me. And we made fake IDs. And back then, it wasn't difficult. Now we got like holograms and barcodes, and it's like a whole different world. Back then, we like took an ID, edited it on like paint on an old Macintosh, and slapped it onto a library card. And that's all that you needed to get into like the local bars here. And there were a couple where like you knew, like, oh, those are the bars that kind of like let underage kids in if they're able to like pay the money and stuff. And I had short hair and kind of like a mature face. So I kind of blended in. And in high school, I started going to the bars. And they thought I was 22 years old. And I started going to the bars so much that one of them like hired me to like DJ mod night playing 60s music at this local bar. And I was like 16 years old. And so my friends became much older. My environment was that of like bars and people that were using, and that was the lifestyle that I wanted to lead. When I was 17 years old, I did my junior year of high school as a foreign exchange student. And the place that I chose to go was Ireland because I didn't have to learn a different language and because I knew that they really liked drinking there. That was literally my primary motivation. I don't remember much from like the 6 to 9 months that I lived there. I did understand why they drink a lot with the weather and the food, but it really started to progress. I got really homesick and I started drinking not so much to party at that point, but to start like actually noticeably changing the way that I felt. And by the time that I got back, I did a shortened senior year and I got this job at this restaurant. And this is where stuff really started to turn for the worse. I met my soulmate. He was a line cook, because aren't they all? And he had a Thug Life tattoo on his belly and a receding hairline and a Louisville Slugger tattoo. And I mean, he was perfect and I loved him. And, you know, he was like 33 and I was 17, but that didn't matter. Us against the world, Bonnie and Clyde. And he had just gotten out of prison for armed robbery. You know, as a 17-year-old, like looking back, it's like, wow, so many red flags, like just the nothing but a red flag. But at the time, that was like, appealing to me. I was very like impulsive and had this desire for like chaos and adventure. And that he had that written all over him. So we started kind of taking up, and I did not realize it at the time, but he was like very into harder substances like cocaine and stuff, and actually sold them. And so all of a sudden I'm introduced to this like very large world of guns and dealing and like shady characters and going across state lines and a lot of felonies that luckily I didn't get, but I got arrested my first time with just like a joint in my car that was his joint, and he ran and I took the blame for it because, you know, I was the Bonnie to his Clyde, and that's what you do, ride or die. Terrible mentality to have. I went to jail. I only spent the night and I was like, oh, well, that wasn't that bad. And I kind of wore it like a badge of honor. Luckily, this man left. At the time, I was absolutely devastated, but ended up being probably one of the best things to happen. And I just kept doing what I was doing and I got more and more reckless. At this point, to deal with that breakup is when I really started picking up music. And I had played piano as a kid, but I taught myself guitar during this period of like mourning that relationship. And I was just in this like double wide trailer out in Bardstown, Kentucky, teaching myself guitar and drinking Franzia box wine until I passed out every day. That was life. Smoking pyramid cigarettes, the most disgusting things in the world. It was not a high class situation. But I did that, and eventually I came back to Louisville and I got this residency. And residency is where you play the same bar every weekend. I played this residency. I'm 20 years old. My fake ID now says I'm like 26 at this point or something. I'm still rocking with the same old faithful. And I'm trying to drive to my grandma's house, who I was living with, because I had drank all of my cab money. And I'm driving down Shelbyville Road and like doing this like S swerve all the way down in and out of like lanes of traffic. And I get pulled over and I get a DUI and I get taken to jail. And I go to jail and I get out the next day and I celebrate by drinking. And then the next weekend, I go to the same bar and I drink just about the same amount. And I get in the same car and I drive down the same road and I get arrested in the same Outback Steakhouse parking lot by the same two police officers. For a DUI, 2 in 1 week at 20 years old. This time they weren't letting me out after 24 hours. They're like, you're gonna sit here for a minute. And that was the first time that I was court ordered to some kind of recovery thing. And it was a 12-step meeting. And I sat in the back of the 12-step meeting, and there was this woman telling her story. And she was talking about, man, like when I start drinking, I can't stop. And I'm like, okay, that's me. Got it. She's like, yeah, it's causing all these problems. I can't seem to manage it. I can like stop for periods of time, but I can't stay stopped. I was like, cool, yeah, that's me. And then she starts talking about taking pain pills and CPS taking her baby away. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's not me. You know, I'm 20 years old. I'm a musician. It's just part of the lifestyle. Like, I'm not going to do anything different. And I didn't. And the next couple of years were really just alcoholic chaos. I got terrible tattoos. I got arrested for disorderly conduct and inciting a riot and was just running around like a crazy person. I would wake up next to strange men. I would wake up in strange cities. I was a total liability. I mean, no regard for myself or anyone else. And then one morning, I was particularly hungover. I had some kind of serving job at some restaurant. I had the worst headache I've ever had in my life. And there was a guy there. I think his letter was just his name was just a letter. I don't know if you know those people. It was like D or Q or something like that. I don't remember what it was. But he was like, hey, I got something for that headache, you know? And I knew it was some kind of pain pill. I tried pain pills sometime in like high school and they didn't really do it for me. So I was like, eh, that's fine. I'll take one. But this time it hit different. And that sense of ease and comfort, I don't know. People had talked about pain medicine and how it makes them sleepy and lazy. And this made me feel like I was Superwoman. I mean, I was just working a serving job, but I was the best fucking server on planet Earth that day. I was doing five people's jobs, running around with a smile on my face, happy as a clam. I had never felt anything like it. So this was a much more high-powered opiate than anyone that I'd ever done. And I immediately fell in love. And from that day forward, I was going to do whatever it took to feel that way all the time. So I did. And I had all these little lines with myself, like, okay, well, I'm gonna do pain pills, but I'm never gonna do anything stronger, right? Until it was right when like all the pill mills came crashing down in like 2011, 2012, and you couldn't find anything, you know? So I moved to like the Opanas, and then the Opanas, you couldn't find those. And then they were like $120 for one pill. And then I had somebody on a trip to Chicago that was like, well, just try this. And like I knew in the back of my mind that it was heroin. And there was a part of me that was like, I would never do heroin. And then there was another savvy economical part where it's like, well, they're using half as much and getting twice as high for a third of the price. I mean, this is just basic finance 101, Sydney. You'd be an idiot not to transition into this market. So with that note, I snorted heroin for the first time, and that was an even more dangerous experience with how my body responded to it immediately. And I did that until I developed a tolerance. Before you know it, I was like 22, 23 years old, and I was shooting a gram of heroin a day and didn't really have anything to show for myself, was skipping from job to job. Just kind of the definition of when people use the derogatory of junkie. That's where I was at. And doing stuff like stealing from people, lying, throwing people under the bus, stealing people's dope, helping them look for it, just all the shady criminal things that you hear about people doing. is me all over. I like, you know, stole a woman's purse at a bar, just stuff that I never would have seen myself participating in. It was like I had these blinders on, and the only thing that I could see was like getting the next one, and I was trapped. So then I met this other guy, and he wore collared shirts, and he had a job, and he's like really nice. And I was like, okay, this is like what's going to fix me, right? Like this guy, he runs at like 6 in the morning. Who does that? That's not natural. I'm going to get that kind of like self-discipline and self-love through osmosis through this relationship. Obviously, it didn't work like that. But what did happen is a couple of months into our fling, I got really, really sick. And I thought I was just like sick from the dope that I was using. And I went to urgent care and they did some like blood tests and stuff. And they said, congratulations, you're pregnant. And I sobbed because that is not what I was expecting. I had been on Depo Provera for quite some time. It had failed. I was in that like 1% where I got pregnant even on birth control and was like a very active heroin addict. I did not know what to do with that. I cried. And I, you know, honestly, I considered all of my options. Like, what am I going to do here? How do I handle this? And ultimately, I decided, well, this is going to be the thing that's going to fix me, right? Because moms, you always hear that story. Like, a mom has a kid and all of a sudden she's unselfish and loves this child more than life itself. And they stop partying and they just become this, like, I guess, I mean, that's the fantasy or the ideal that I saw on TV and everything. And I'm like, this is what's going to do it. I'm going to love this kid so much that I'm going to be willing to do anything for her, including getting off substances. And that's how it's going to work. And amazingly, I was able to get off of heroin throughout my pregnancy. Did not use that substance. I did develop hyperemesis gravidarum to where I puked every day and almost had to be put on a feeding tube. And so I did smoke weed throughout my pregnancy. And it was one of those things to where it was like what we would now consider harm reduction. It was like, okay, I wasn't using this much more dangerous substance, but I needed a little something to get me through the day because I hadn't been introduced to like real recovery yet. I didn't know what was wrong with me. And it helped stimulate appetite, curb nausea, and I actually did gain the weight that I needed to gain while using that substance. So I don't have a lot of regret about that, actually, if I'm being honest. But what happened was I gave birth to the most beautiful, angelic, sweet creature that I'd ever seen in my life. And I held her in my arms and I felt that overwhelming feeling of love and tenderness. Then the thought crossed my mind of like, I wonder how much pain medicine they're going to give me. And something crazy happened at the hospital. You know, I had a tear, they had to give me pain medication. But what happened after that is the doctor accidentally overprescribed my take-home pain medicine. So I was supposed to get, I think, 80 milliliters of liquid Percocet. And he put an extra zero. So I got a prescription for 800 milliliters of liquid Percocet. That's like a liter. It was several bottles. So at the time, I thought I'd won the lottery. I'm like, this is the best day of my life. Like, thank God, you know, looking out for me. This is amazing. And for the first couple of weeks, it was. I was super mom, man. I couldn't understand these people that were like complaining about how difficult motherhood was. I was doing the dishes and doing the laundry, had the kid and the little strap and was like handling and felt good. And then I ran out. And what happened when I ran out is I was alone with a baby in that trailer out in Bardstown. Because my partner was like working a lot of the time to try to support us. And I was dope sick. I couldn't take care of myself. I was like on the toilet or next to the toilet. And I had this like newborn baby. And so I thought, okay, like I got to do something about this. I have to get well before I can make any kind of a decision. So I made my mind up. I'm going to get one more. I'm going to get well. And then I'm going to go to some kind of treatment or do something. So I called a guy that I knew that was in Louisville, met up with him. This is the story about how I wound up on the 5 o'clock news. I used with him and I overdosed in a Walmart parking lot with my kid in the back seat. And he ran and he left me there. You know, at the time, that was a really fucked up thing to do. But at the same time, when you're in that lifestyle, I couldn't tell you with any guarantee that I wouldn't have done something similar in his position. They found me because my car was parked next to the shopping cart little area. One of the workers came out and found me slumped over the steering wheel with my daughter crying in the back seat. So I woke up handcuffed to a hospital bed, not knowing what the hell just happened. And I think that was the first time that I was really confronted by my lack of control. Like I really just wanted one more. And here I am, like my entire life is ruined. I've made the worst mistake that I've ever made. And even thinking like, what if the car, they told me, oh, she was just like taken to the hospital, make sure she was okay, she's fine. But I'm like, what if the car doors had been left open and like she had been stolen, like so many things. If she had been injured, if I hadn't been found and I died and she was left without a mother, all these thoughts running through my head. And just the reality that I was not convinced, because I think that that's how I had been running that entire time. So this was the first time, handcuffed to a hospital bed. CPS comes in. I'm very lucky that I got like a brand new young Christian CPS worker that was trying to save the world. So he actually treated me like a human being, which I know is not everybody's experience that deals with CPS. And he really wanted to help me. And so he got me into treatment. That was my first time into a treatment program. And I went to a women's IOP program. I did the best that I could. I showed up. I jumped through all the hoops. I went to the parenting classes, but there was a thought in the back of my head, right? They had told me the only reason that I had overdosed is because I was one of the first people, this is back in 2013, had gotten like fentanyl in their opiates. It took four Narcan to revive me. And luckily I was right next to a hospital. The Walmart's next to the hospital. So I'm like, well, it wasn't that like I was using, I just, it was a bad batch. This has nothing to do with whether or not I can use successfully. It was just, that was a bad thing. And that thought haunted me. That entire time through treatment, it stayed in the back of my mind. And I know what that is now is a reservation. And I just would flirt with it and play with it and massage it out. And after I graduated the treatment program, right before I was supposed to take the test that would give me custody of my kid back, the night before I used. And so I showed up to the drug test knowing what would happen. I didn't pass. And the next year, 2014, is really just there was a montage scene in a movie. It is me in and out of treatment, in and out of homeless shelters, using, getting sober for 20 days, 10 days, 2 days, back in treatment, back on the streets, went to every treatment center in my city, some in a couple of different cities. And then I ended up, all this time I'm like popping back in and out of my daughter's life. My daughter, he had moved up to Cincinnati at that point to be close to his family to get help with raising her. I'd come to Louisville, go to treatment, go to Cincinnati, be good wife, good mom for a week, 2 weeks, maybe 30 days, and then I would relapse and then hide it and lie. And then he'd find out and I'd be back to treatment over and over again. And I finally realized, he resented me so much and rightfully so for how I had put our daughter in danger and for how I continued to just lie and put him through the wringer, that he was not able to treat me with respect anymore. And when I came back, he came back just to kind of like punish me. And that was not an environment that I was going to get clean in. And so I had to make the hardest choice of my life. I just had this realization, if I'm ever going to get clean, I have to leave him and I have to basically abandon my child for a period of time to get the help that I need. So I moved to Louisville, I packed my stuff. I had this other thought that was swirling around in the back of my mind, right? Well, heroin clearly is not for me, right? I used heroin for the last time sometime in August of 2014. But alcohol, maybe I could drink, it wasn't so bad. That's not that dangerous one. So I came to Louisville. And I just drank. And it was interesting because there were a couple of times where I'd go to the bar and I'd have a beer or two beers and I'd go home. And I was like, see, I can do this. And then the fourth or fifth time, maybe a couple too many, fine. The 10th time, I would end up next to a stranger, don't know where my car is, don't know where my keys are, looking at messages on my phone, trying to piece together what the hell happened the night before. And it just started, the pattern started to emerge. Like maybe it's not just the opiates here. Maybe I've always had a problem. Maybe this is a me problem and not a substance problem. And I tested that theory out my last night of using. So November 20th of 2014, I drank all night, wound up with some unsavory characters who I used to drink with in like my late teens and early 20s at this house party that was just like, if you've ever seen one of those movies where they try to do a really good job of showing you like the image of depravity, people passed out, people like doing unseemly things in a corner. There's like burnt cigarettes everywhere. Like you can just tell that's like where I was. And I became very aware of that. And I went and I was staying at my grandmother's house in her guest bedroom at the time. And I went after doing alcohol, ended up doing a bunch of cocaine. Oh, the birds started chirping. I went back to grandma's house. She had like this judgmental portrait of Jesus that was staring down at me. I'm in the fetal position, just like sobbing and wanting to die. And I just had that thought of like, what am I doing? And I looked over on the nightstand table and there was like one of those little mittens from when my daughter was like an infant. And by this time, she was like a year old. And it was just that moment of clarity to where I was really confronted with how bad it was, like how dark it had really gotten, how unsustainable it was. And then even somewhat of like a picture of what it could be. I play music and I'm good at it. I could be a really good, like basically just the thought that kept running in my head is like, what the fuck am I doing? The next day I went to a meeting.
You had said that at one point you had realized that it wasn't the drug and alcohol, that it was a you problem. How old were you when you finally came to that conclusion?
24, right before I ended up getting sober. I mean, it took all that time to really see that the common denominator was looking right at me in the mirror, and it wasn't all these external things that I blamed or substances I was using, that it really, I was the person in the pattern.
You said you had gone to a meeting after being at your grandmother's and seeing the mitten, having that realization of like, what the fuck am I doing with myself? When you went to your first meeting, how was it? What was it? What you expected? Just kind of if you want to touch more on that, just so we can hear a little bit about how it was when you first started in the rooms.
Yeah. So, I'd been to that meeting in my 20s, and throughout those times in treatment, if you're familiar with treatment culture, a lot of the times they'll take you to outside meetings, so I'd get like 20 days and I'd pop into the rooms and sit in the back with my arms folded, not really paying attention, get my little sheet sign and scurry on out of there. This was the first time I went to the meeting with the intention of, oh, I'm going to a meeting. Like I want to be here. And so I found some, like, no offense with this language, but like crusty old timer meetings, because I didn't want people who had seen me around before to see me, because I just kind of wanted to be like really anonymous. I'd made all these promises all these times about, oh, like this is going to be the time and I'm really going to get sober this time. And I just had some shame like coming back into the rooms of like, oh, here she is again. Wonder how long she's going to last. I don't think anybody was thinking that, but I was. So my first several meetings, I went to like one of the clubs that we have here. I went to like this old church and it was mostly these like old timer meetings. And at first I was, these people are mean as fuck. A lot of them were just like yelling at me, but especially God, I hate that, like, keeps coming back. And I was like, oh, great. But it kind of like secured my resolve. I made a resolve, like, I'm not gonna get offended out of these meetings. And then I started like sharing at these meetings and like getting involved and meeting some people. And this interesting experience happens. The best, I think it was like at 30 days sober, I'd met this guy like kind of in the rooms, and he asked for help with his dad. His dad was in the hospital, right? I'm like, oh yeah, I have 30 days sober. I'm in a great position to come by myself and help you with your like very ill dad and being an emotional support with where I'm at right now. I went with him to the hospital and it was okay until I walked into the room and they happened to be giving him his pain medication. And I watched that look wash over his face. And I walked out the door and I got into my car and I grabbed my phone. And I called that number that I had deleted, but I will never forget. And I was driving up the street and I was like ready to go. And then that little voice in the back of my head was like, don't do it. Like, what happened? What would happen if you just like didn't? Just this like one time. You always just do it. Like, what would happen if you just didn't? And I'd never really considered that, which is kind of amazing to me. Like, oh, I could like change my mind right now. And so I called a friend I'd met at one of those meetings, and I'm like, I have to go to a meeting right now. Stay on the phone with me until you hear the readings. Stay on the phone. And so she did. And I found this meeting, and it was a 10:30 at night on a Saturday meeting. I had all these like asterisks next to it that I didn't understand, but I just knew there was a meeting. It was at 10:30. And so I burst into the doors crying about like, I want to use and I don't know what I'm doing and I need help. Not realizing I had just completely like bombarded this like older gay men's meeting. There was like 10 of them in there eating like chocolate and sipping on their like coffee. But what happened was I like rambled and interrupted their whole like reading ritual and everything like that. And they stood up and all of them gave me a big hug and said, you're home now. We've got you. And that was my first home group. I went there for like 2 years and they made me feel super welcome. And it was just that experience of coming into a room sobbing and leaving feeling more relief than I'd ever felt. It was incredible. It's a very different experience with the rooms this time around than I had previously had.
So in that situation, you used an actual coping mechanism. You, when you got triggered, you played the tape forward and you said, and this is something that it takes a while to learn usually. And it, I already know what happens when I go down that road. This number that I deleted that I know by heart, my dealer, I can call and I can get what I want right now because this is what I want. But I know what happens when I take that road. So what if I don't do that and I call somebody from the rooms instead and force them to stay on the phone with me until I get to the meeting? That is a tool in our toolbox. You used it at just the right time, your head at just the right time, and you followed that instinct at just the right time. I don't know where you are spiritually, but do you feel like perhaps the universe or there was some reason, it wasn't a coincidence that that tool popped into your head at that time?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's like with that moment of clarity that brought me to my first meeting and that specific situation, I had been doing this a long time and those were not thoughts that I had. That is not a thought that would have come from my drug-addled, addicted brain. And so I think of, you know, I have a very constantly ever-changing relationship with like what a higher power would be and this, that, and the other, and my understanding of spirituality. But I do know like those experiences, especially that one, of literally driving too. I had never in my life before been on the way to COP, been on the way to a bar and said, you know what? I think I'm going to not do that. I think that's a bad idea. Maybe I'll just turn around. Never, never. And so the fact that the thought even entered my head, much less that I trusted it and followed through with the action behind it, it's not just like, that's not a thought that came from me. You know, I don't know what it came from. I don't spend too much time trying to like solve the mysteries of the world and God and the universe, but I just do know that it wasn't me.
Yeah. That's some powerful shit right there, girlfriend. So I have a question from a little bit from your past for you that I want to ask you about. After you had OD'd in the parking lot at Walmart and your daughter was taken away from you, you worked so hard to get to a position where the next day was going to be the day that you get to be reunited with your daughter and you get to get her back, right? Okay, big deal, big responsibility. Last time you were in charge of her, you were pretty much dead in the front seat and she was crying in the back seat. Obviously, her health and safety was not your priority, right? And this is the day before you're about to get her back. You know you're going to fail the test. You know you're not going to get your daughter back. You know what all the consequences are, and you use. What kind of fear, self-doubt were you feeling? What was that? Because obviously you did it for a reason. You were scared shitless. Not ready. I don't know what it was. That's what my question is to you. Like, what, looking back now and what was going through your head, it's like you were about to get the thing that everybody strives for. And you're like, I'm going to self-sabotage this right now because I am scared shitless, full of fear, whatever. What was
it? I think it was a combination of things. One of them is I knew I wasn't done. You know, I had been playing with that reservation for long enough that I knew somewhere in the back of my mind that I was not done using. I did not trust myself as a using person with the responsibility of being a parent, at least in that like primary custody capacity. I think on another angle, I mean, there was a lot of shame. So with it being a news story, also, I don't know if you ever see news stories that are put on Facebook and how people like to get in the comment stuff. So I had this like little ritual in early recovery where I would go and look up my story and look up all the wonderful comments and the things that they had to say about me, you know, like, oh, I hope that they threw the book at her and she never gets her kid out. That woman's a monster. She should be put away forever. What a piece of shit. Mother of the Year award goes to this one. You know what I mean? And it's like, there was a part of me, like almost as like a form of self-harm, that I would just like go and read those comments and just, because I felt I deserved it. It was like almost like when you see in those movies the people like with the lash that are lashing their back as some kind of like penance. I felt like I deserved to hurt a lot. And so I did that to myself. And so I think, the more I read it, the more I started to really believe it too. Of like, yeah, I'm not capable of being a good parent. I'm not capable, like I don't deserve to get her back. What have I done? And I think too, like, I had been in the rooms. I went to a different fellowship that first time. I went to NA fellowship for that period of time because I was convinced I wasn't an alcoholic. I just had a problem with opiates. And so I was different and I needed to do this kind of thing. And in there, I was, I only ever shared about the good stuff. I'm like, oh yeah, I can tell how much gratitude I have and serenity by how I respond in traffic. So I didn't have an outlet for like the painful feelings that I was going through because I was too concerned with like maintaining some kind of like an image and recovery and being seen a certain way. So it just built like over month of not seeing her and not seeing her. And then I started to get paranoid. I was looking up these articles of military mothers that like didn't get to see their kids and the studies they did on like the attachment and abandonment issues these children would have. And I just really like psyched myself out of like, I fucked up my kid forever. I don't deserve to see her. I'm not done using. It was the perfect storm that I had reconnected with some people in the rooms that, they're not everybody is in the rooms to find recovery. You can spot them from a mile away, the ones that are not really serious about it. And I kind of found those in the previous week. And I'd gotten the invitation just that night. And I was like, you know what? I thought that was a spiritual thing. Here we go. Here it is right in front of me. Let's just get it over with. It was almost like that. Like, let's just get this over with. Like, I know I'm going to use at some point. Let's just do it now so I don't even have to worry about like signing paperwork and, getting my kid back and stuff because I'm going to lose it all anyway.
So it all comes down to I know I'm not done. I know I'm going to use anyway. Constantly rereading those negative comments about you and reinforcing what a shitty ass person you are and what a fucked up mother you are and you shouldn't be trusted taking care of another human being. You are solidifying the fact that that shit is true, and I am in no position to be taking care of another person, so I'm gonna use. And it's almost like that was what you did justify using and not going through with what you need, what you could have gone through with, but you knew you were gonna go back out. But you had to have that just some kind of moral reinforcement. And it was the morality of this. Look at saying, I can't do this. This would be a horrible thing if I was her mother. So to justify the actions that you knew were coming.
That, and I think I wanted some control over my relapse because I knew that it was an inevitability. I was like, okay, well, I'm gonna just do it now so I get it over with and done with. And it's not like, oh, I create this little happy home up in Ohio and like everything's honky dory and then I blindside everybody like by doing it. Like, let's just like since I know it's gonna happen, let's just go ahead and do it now. I'll have some control over like the PR, the consequences and this and that, and how to handle all of that because I'm doing it on my terms.
Yep, on your terms. So the normalization of alcohol in your up chaos, cops always there. This is just kind of life kind of thing. Do you feel like that was something that you were also afraid of maybe bringing into your daughter's life and kind of like perpetuating that, keeping the tradition going? Or and when did you realize that you had the capability of ending that sabotage in family, drinking and
Yeah,
all
and
that?
so I mean it went back even further than that. It was like, my grandfather was a morphine addict and then my dad and like all of these different factors and stuff. I do think that that was a big part of it. I looked at my family of origin and when I made the decision because it was like a choice to bring a child into this world, I did not want her to go through what I went through and witness what I witnessed. I wanted things to be very different for her. And before that first pain pill hit my mouth, I was utterly determined to provide all of that for her. And so as I'm kind of like watching myself almost third person in this like spiral, I do have those fears of like, oh, okay, we're just doing this again. passing it right on down the line. Here we go. Just like dad, just like grandpa, just like this and that. And in recovery, I did this really cool thing. You know, there's a lot of talk these days about like breaking generational curses and stuff. And I even went to this thing, maybe I was at like year three, and it's this workshop called like Family Constellation. And it's one of the weirdest things I've ever done in my life, right? They like ask you a question, and there's a room full of people. All these people sign up and you all participate. And they'll say, you know, like, what do you want to know? And one of my questions I had was like, you know, why don't I feel like connected to people? I have a hard time connecting with people. And so they have these people, they're like, okay, here's your question. So they're like, all right, choose who you want to represent your mom, choose who you want to represent dad, choose grandpa, choose this person. And the theory is that everything is energy, and that these people, through representing these people, are naturally going to inhabit some of the energy of these people, whether living or dead, right? And it was very strange because the person that was my mother was a very calm person, kind of sitting there. And as soon as she inhabited my mother, was tapping her foot and check watch, just like my mother does. And the person that was playing my father had the same posture. And it was like the strangest, I didn't know what I'd gotten myself into. And it's supposed to like paint this picture, right? And like all of them are looking away from each other. And they're like, see? Nobody's like, of course you feel disconnected. And in that moment, with this like weird snapshot of all of like my family represented out there, and seeing like generation after generation, even them bringing great grandfather back and he looks miserable, and great great grandfather back and the person representing him looks miserable. It was like, this has been going on forever. This is just what we do. And then I did have that moment because I was the person, part of the process was I was to look at them. Like, I'm gonna look. Y'all are all looking away, but I'm gonna look. And it was a really powerful experience. I wrote a song about it. It's on Spotify. You know, it was one of those like very life-changing woo-woo things that I did, but it really just occurred to me that it ends here. I'm not doing this. I'm not carrying on the family legacy of anesthetizing all of my feelings and not looking and passing this on to my child. I'm going to do things very, very different from here forward.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song too. And when you sing it live, I mean, you're very professional, of course, but like the emotion is super there. You can feel it, which is a beautiful thing also. That is like a really awesome kind of almost therapy. I don't know where you did this exactly. Was this at a meeting or?
No, I mean, the amount of weird stuff that I have done to supplement my like kind of 12-step recovery is it knows no ends. I have done so many things of, you know, trying to find answers about my past, trying to self-reflect, trying to like move into spirituality in different ways. And it was just, you know, I had some friends who had done this, and they're like, you know, everybody knows me, I'm a yes girl. And they're like, hey, Sydney, you want to try this like weird workshop based on this like Norwegian energy family constellation thing? And I'm like, sure, count me in. And it was just, you know, you signed up, and it was at this retreat center, and here we all were. And a lot of people were older. It was an interesting group of people. But I've done a ton of just different, you know, kind of like self-help or therapy or self-discovery based things along recovery that are kind of out there.
Like different workshops and just different modalities, and just you had an open mind to it because not everybody that would be put in that situation would have gotten out of it what you got out of it. So like that worked for you. You know, just like we say, like everyone's recovery is different. That worked for you for whatever reason, that point in your life, your mind was open to it. You weren't too fucking weirded out by it because some people would be. And you just followed direction and you did it. And then you were able to gain some kind of eye-opening experience and realize like, hey, this is almost like my responsibility. Stop this. Like, I can do this. Look at how long my family has been miserable. I know better. It is my responsibility to do this, and I can, and I'm going to. Watch me. And then I'm gonna write a beautiful fucking song about it and spill beautiful emotions out. That's That's just pretty fucking cool, dude. I really think that's awesome.
So talking about that, how did that kind of change your perspective, and what did you do with that in order to make changes in your recovery with that, knowing what you learned through that experience?
Through that particular experience, I think, and I feel like a lot of people that, especially people that are kind of like low bottom addiction or alcoholics, a question I had in the back of my mind is like, am I a sociopath? Am I not capable of feeling things or connecting with people or loving or being loved? Like, I had that thought, maybe it's just a lack of path. And looking at that, just looking at all of these family members just turned away, and it was just about like disconnect. I think it just gave me that sense of, I'm not inherently broken. I tend to be disconnected because of look at how, where I come from. It's going to take some time and it's going to take some work, but I'm not a monster who doesn't, not capable of loving their child. I'm not a sociopath. It's just going to take some time. And so the biggest lesson that I carried forward with that is like, I mean, it was hope. It was like, okay, like, I'm not defective. This is a real hope shot for me. And what I'm going to do with it is like really try to form a stable parental bond with my child and with like my recovery support system. Just trust that I'm capable of love and being loved, which I mean was hugely important, obviously.
Definitely. So you said you took that into how you're going to build your relationship with your daughter, that you were about to get your daughter and then you relapsed. How long after that did it take you to get back your daughter?
I do have my daughter back now, and that was a very rocky road. So with that, I gave up the option for custody. Now, when I would pop in and out in 2014 before I got sober, I got to see her for periods of time under the condition that I was living in the house with that partner doing that. So in 2014, when I came to Louisville with the decision, like, I'm going to get help. Like, I'm not going to seek out a relationship with my child until I'm in a position where I'm healthy enough to be in a position to do that for her. And so it was maybe 60, 90 days the first time I saw her. It was like supervised. And then from there, I got every other weekend. And I had to meet him halfway in Cincinnati each weekend. And really, the credit goes to my now fiance. He would drive me up there because it turns out the state of Ohio decided I shouldn't have a driver's license for quite a long time, which I found out about like 100 days sober when I got pulled over with a suspended license. But we'd drive up there and we'd pick her up every other weekend. And that is how it was, every other weekend and sometimes summers and break for several years. It was a tough part of my recovery because I'm hearing all these people and you hear the promises and this, that, and the other. And I kind of had to accept that that is a thing that I may never get back. Like, I may be the every other weekend parent permanent. I may not be able to repair that. And especially as a mom, that's hard. And I could go on a whole other rant about how, you know, the justice system is really unfair to fathers, but nobody bats an eye when a dad has every other weekend because that's kind of how it's done. But if a mom has every other weekend, you know, she fucked up. So even telling people, oh, I don't have primary custody of my kid, I'd get that look for years and years, no matter what setting I was in, you know, in the rooms that I didn't get looked, but coworkers and this and that. I mean, it was just haunt. And that news article was still there. Like, if I'd go for job interviews, they'd Google Sydney Sled and that article would be the first thing that would pop up. And it was really tough. And I went to court at a certain time trying to get like more time. But because like I lived in Louisville and I chose to live in Louisville and she lived in Cincinnati, they saw no reason to move her locations. That's like where her consistency was. And I couldn't argue with that. And I wasn't willing to move up from Cincinnati because that's where the majority of my opiate use occurred. And I didn't have any, you know, I had built a whole foundation of recovery in this city and I wasn't willing to give that up. How I got primary custody was at the beginning of COVID when there was no longer any child care or school care. And my kid's father was finally in the position for the very first time to be like full-time stay-at-home solo parent. I got a call 3 weeks later. Hey, you want to take her? And I was like, yes, let's get the paperwork now. I had him sign the paperwork. He was going through some of his own personal struggles and like a relationship and other stuff going on. And I jumped on the opportunity. So it was kind of wild because I went from having every other weekend and this limited amount of time to all of a sudden I'm her mother and I'm her teacher doing NTI classes in the first grade, which that was chaos in and of itself. And like full time. not just full time, but like full time. Like all we're in a house together all the time. And in some ways that was tough, but I think it made the transition period go so much quicker. It was like, okay, here's the two of you. We're throwing you in a pot, figure it out. And there was some adjustment. There was some, meltdowns and us kind of figuring out, like, what do you even really like to eat? What are your routines? Oh, you don't really have any. Let's establish some. Here's the boundaries. Yeah, I mean, and I've had primary custody of her ever since. Her dad ended up last year moving down to Louisville. And so we do much more of kind of like a 50-50 kind of style of custody or had for a period. It was cool. I didn't get to see her first step. I wasn't there for that. I didn't get to see her first word. But when she lost her first tooth, it was in the pandemic, and I got to be at the Tooth Fairy, and I was so excited. I gave her $20, which I understand is entirely too much money, but I was very excited about it. So that's how it was. And yeah, and now like we're like best friends. That's my kid is my whole life, is my person. We snuggle on the couch. We go on little adventures. We look for bugs in the backyard. And it's very cool because I was so worried that like too much time had passed. I'd lost too much time. It wasn't going to be the same. I had done permanent damage. And there may be things. We'll have a conversation one day. Like I have things to be accountable for when the time comes for a conversation like that. But kids are so resilient and so forgiving. And when she came in, she just loved on me immediately and tells me all the time that I'm the best mom in the world. And it's incredible how all that worked out.
So I know we've talked about the relationship with your daughter a lot within this podcast, and I think that after Alyssa just asked you that last question, I think that your answer spoke volumes about the necessity of getting sober and maintaining healthy recovery for yourself first. You did not move to Cincinnati where you drugged and drank and had this hard past. You stayed in your recovery world, even though that meant that that prolonged any chance of a stable relationship with your daughter. But you knew even more so that if you didn't stay in your healthy recovery, that there could never, potentially never be a chance of having a relationship with your daughter. That is something that I hope our listeners take in and embrace the fact that, yes, you love your children. We love them. We want to be with them, but we've got to get sober for ourselves first. We've got to maintain our sobriety, a healthy recovery. You did that, and that was a sacrifice, but ultimately, it was a reward.
It was. Well, and like I said, I kind of tried that. I would go to treatment in Louisville and I'd bounce right back to Cincinnati because I'm like, okay, I'm sober and I'm ready to be a mom and I'm ready to show up for my family. And just that guilt, like that mom guilt, like, okay, I've had enough time. Oh my God, I've been gone 30 days and other people are parenting my kid. Like, I've got to get back in there. I've got to get back in there. And like all this pressure, even though I wasn't ready, 30 days is not that long of a time. Like, that's just like getting the fog off of your head, really. And so through that experience of doing that over and over and over again, it was like, this isn't working. Like, I can't just scrape together a couple of weeks and then expect to take on all of this emotional and physical responsibility and to be able to hold all of that. Like, I need a solid foundation before I can start picking up a bunch of weight. Like, even my first job, I got like a very easy receptionist job. I was like, I cannot have a whole lot of stress. I cannot tackle all of the baggage of my past in the first 30, 60, 90 days. This is a process. This has to be a marathon instead of a sprint because I kept trying to sprint it and I'd run out of gas and I'd relapse. And I'm like, I have to slow my pace down. I have to get my business in order and first really focus on like my recovery, my state of mind. And even certain things like, am I in a financial position to take care of a kid? I don't even have a driver's license. What am I going to do with a kid full time, until I get a driver's license? How am I going to get her to preschool? Just little stuff. And I started thinking like a sober person. Oh, wow. okay, here are some things I should probably have, some like furniture and clothes at my house instead of having the go bag that goes back. And just it is that guilt, it is a lot to carry, but at the same time, it's what you said. I had felt the guilt of what it feels like to go back too soon and then have to leave. And granted, like when I got sober, my daughter was 18 months old. She probably doesn't have any real recollection of me bouncing in and out, but I knew that if I continued that path, I'd start getting disappointed looks, disappointed call, you know, like I was just so tired of disappointing people. Like I'd come in ready to go and then I would leave again. And I'm like, that's not fair. Like I have to stop doing this. I either have to like put my money where my mouth is and get real recovery before I enter this child's life again, or I need to just go use and stop coming back.
Sounds like you were learning some humility within that process, that you were taking some advice perhaps from other people in the rooms and really embracing the 12 steps of recovery and other things that other different models that you used. What does Sydney's life look like now? Tell us about.
Well, and essentially it's so hard to separate the two these days, you know, who I am as a person in recovery and who I am in general. Like most of the people that I surround myself with are other people in recovery, just because we have that common tie in common. So it makes it easy to build these friendships based on that experience. And another thing is we are interested in doing a lot of the same things, you know, and I know it's not going to be like a liability going on a night out. I have some people that are, I don't particularly love the word normies. I don't know, but just people that are not alcoholic. I love them too. But my life is wonderful and busy and crazy. This year has been one of the most insane years ever. I went back to school at a certain point. I went to a trade school and I became a massage therapist. I got into this really weird subset of massage of doing lymphatic drainage for post-surgical clients. And that, it turns out, has such a need around it that in the middle of the pandemic, my friends and I, who were both trained in that, opened a business together. And we now have 7 employees. So we're hiring and training more people, expanding into a second location. So, I mean, from the person that couldn't get a job because of the news article, like I'm now the owner and CEO of a business that my business partner and I started from the ground up. This is also the first year that I've really dedicated to doing music. You know, that was kind of the hardest thing to integrate into recovery for me, because even in the media, it becomes very obvious of like the lifestyle of musicians is very inundated with drugs and alcohol. And that's not entirely untrue. That's a lot. Most concerts take place at bars. A lot of times you get paid in alcohol. Like that's how they pay you, is in a bar tab plus a little bit of cash. And so I came very slow. I did like open mic nights at first, and I'd play like recovery centered events and things like that. But I think I had this like very perfectionistic fear of doing anything with my music and the vulnerability of putting myself out there in that way. So this year was the first year that I went into like a recording studio and recorded a song with like all the little fluff of different instruments and things, and released it with a music video. I'm releasing another song with a music video on January 6th, and really stepping into that creative place that I love to be on my terms of like, I'm not going to play shows that I don't want to play in environments that I don't want to play, and that's okay. I make my money through my business, which is awesome, so I can do whatever I want, music. Some of the other stuff with recovery. So, like, my grandmother was a place where I lived on and off throughout my recovery. That was like my little safe spot. You know, she was my number one enabler in some ways, but also like my person and my safe place, safe haven for a lot of years in other ways. With COVID, she lives by herself. I think being kind of cooped up in that house without that social interaction, it really had an impact on her. And she already had a little bit of Alzheimer's and it got worse. Of all the people in my family, I was deemed the person that she wanted to be her power of attorney. So this year I helped her get into assisted living, helped her sell her house, all of her belongings. I go there every Tuesday and Thursday and take her to the bank and refill her medications. And it's just like, that's one of those things that like really speaks recovery to me, because that was a relationship where I took so much. Like, I stole her little Xanaxes that she would take to go to sleep. I took money. I would show up at her house at 3 in the morning and just stumble in drunk and cause a scene. So much chaos. I'd call her when she was like 72 to come pick me up from jail. That poor woman. Like, I just put her through hell. And so to be able to be of service in this way to her, and to be able to be the stablest person in the family, the person who is the most able to care for her. Like, that was a big reflection moment of like, this is what recovery looks like in my life. And it's taking the responsibility without being resentful or feeling burdened. Like, it's a privilege to be able to show up for her in the ways that she always showed up for me. So it's a lot of really cool things. I sponsor women and take them through the 12 steps. I've done some cool stuff as far as like speaking engagements for public agencies, because I'm really open about my recovery. That's why I love like being on this podcast. I post about it on my social media. I have no bones about talking about my past. And I've been able to like talk to CPS workers about like addiction across the state of Kentucky. And that's a big part of my recovery, is trying to reduce the stigma. And I think like when people look at my mugshot and then people see me, how I am today, it's just one of those like visceral before and after pictures that really gets people attention. And then especially with my story of like how bad it got. Like, I OD'd in a Walmart parking lot with my baby in the back seat. And now I'm a successful business owner. I'm a musician. I'm a parent. I'm doing all of these things. And so recovery for me too is not just giving back on an individual basis, but also just showing that change is possible for anyone. Cause there were so many people that had written me off, and I was one of the ones that wasn't gonna make it. And I have this big, fat, juicy life today that is just so incredible. And I want that for everybody else, and just for people to know that like it's a possibility, because there was certainly a time where I couldn't even see it on the horizon. I could not have imagined. I would have sold myself so short if you would have asked me what I wanted out of a sober life. I had no idea it could be this good.
It definitely shows the beautiful things that can happen in recovery. You know, the promises that we're told can happen. You've come so far, and you've built a beautiful life for yourself, helping all of these people and showing them that it, you know, you can get out from the bottom and live a good, sober, happy life. I'm just really grateful that you were able to come on and share that with our listeners.
Yeah, thank you. Me too.
Yeah, absolutely, Sydney. Your story also shows overcoming adversity, resilience, because you didn't get this shit overnight. You had to work and work, fall down, work, get back up, fall down. You didn't do it by yourself. You know you didn't. You had to ask for help, like in the rooms. You gave your all to your recovery and let those promises come as they were supposed to come. Not rushing toward them, focusing on what you needed to focus on, doing the work and letting those things happen the way they needed to happen. That's such a great sense of grace that we learn that we didn't have before. And it's kind of like, I'm just going to be like grateful for my sobriety and the work I'm putting in, and gracefully accept what comes my way. That's a beautiful thing. And it's happened to someone who's got a mugshot heard around the world, you know? And so if like that message right there, it's not ever over for anyone.
No.
So if somebody out there alone, like suffering alone, thinks like, I'm done, I have no future, I hope that they can hear your story and just know that it's fucking possible to get out.
Well, and even about the mugshot, so at about year 5, I decided that I didn't want there to be a news headline that was continuing to kind of hold me to that person that I was. And at this time, I was a receptionist at a law firm, and I was putting myself through massage school, grueling hours of work. And I was looking up online, and they're like, yeah, there's no way to remove a news article from the internet. You have to contact the news agent. I'm like, well, the news agency's not going to get rid of it. There's so many comments. It's getting all these clicks. Like, they don't have any reason to. But I decided from my like very official law office email address to construct this email. And I just said, like, hey, I'm a person in long-term recovery. This happened like 4 years ago. I'm trying to like do a music career and do other things. And anytime somebody Googles me, this article pops up. And I really like would like to move past this and like do really cool things with my life. If there's any way that you would consider like taking this down, it would be so important to me and my recovery and all of this stuff, like just flowered it up really nicely and had my fingers crossed, sent it, didn't hear anything back for a while. And I finally got an email back. He said, consider it done and good luck with your recovery. And so now when you Google my name, you cannot find that mugshot.
Fucking
So
A.
I
Oh
know.
my
Well,
God.
and that
The
was one of those
initiative that
things.
you took to do that. Like, if you were not like you're if you were not working a solid recovery program, like you wouldn't have the confidence to be like, "Listen, I'm doing things, okay?" Like, you know, and I'm in this
Yes.
right headspace to express to you that this is detrimental to a future that I am fucking making for myself, you know? And politely, will you please, you know, take into consideration that this happened then and this is what my life is like now, and you took initiative and look what happened.
Well, and it just goes to show, like, I've just been amazed at like how much redemption is actually possible in recovery. Because there were certain guarantees when I came to recovery that I had accepted that were hard pills to swallow. One of them was that mugshot and that news article will always exist and will always pop up if someone Googles me, that I'm probably never going to get full custody of my kid back, and then I'm going to have to wait until she's 18 to be a meaningful part of her life. That because of my felonies, or like because of my like, I don't have felonies, but I've got tons of misdemeanors. Because of my criminal history, I'm never gonna have that good of a job. Like these were things that were certainties to me in my first year of recovery. And what I did was I just like accepted them, and that was important. And I kept doing the work. And then over the years, one by one, each one of those things that I really did not think was possible, I've gotten half of my record expunged. Half of those criminal charges you can't even find anymore. Because as the dates pop up, I get them wiped off of there. And it's just, I think there's a lot of people out there that kind of stay in the cycle of addiction because they think, like, why bother? I have so much baggage. I'm never going to be able to get past. And you don't immediately. Like I told you, it took me like 6 years in recovery to get primary custody of my kid back. It took 5 years for that article to come down. It took several years for those charges to even be available to be expunged. But just by like, people are like, oh, well, how did you get 8 years? It's that cheesy thing, like one day at a time. I just like kept doing the work and putting one foot in front of the other. And all of a sudden, all these opportunities presented themselves. And I was in the right state of mind and in a good place to like know, intuitively handle situations which used to baffle us. I was ready to go. I knew what to do.
And you did it. And you keep on doing the damn thing. And you sober out loud. And we appreciate that so much. And wish you the best with everything that you're doing. And just, I mean, you are naturally going to continue to amaze, I can see. And thank you so much for taking your time to be on our podcast, Salty Moms Gone Sober, and share your story and be vulnerable with us and our listeners. Like, I love that our listeners got to he like get to hear this. Like,
And
thank you.
don't forget, stay salty, stay sober, stay sane.
Thank you so much to all our listeners. If you like what you heard, tune in next Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for another episode of Salty Moms Gone Sober. Be there or be square. And in the meantime, stay salty, stay sober, stay sane. Peace.